welcome to this latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined once again by producer Miles and David Holmes, but it's not just the three of us for this intro. We've also got Mr. Phil Brining back with us after quite a long time off. Phil, hello.
Hello, hello. Yes, quite a lengthy absence. I apologise to everybody who's going to listen to the podcast because I was quite giddy about getting on. So I kind of found myself running away all the time, verbal diarrhea. So, yes, it was nice to be back.
I can't believe that this is the third take of this intro that we've done because I've messed up three of them and you've just used that turn of phrase in the one that's going to stay in the edit. But no matter. Well, onwards and upwards, I suppose. Dave, can you provide a little bit of balance here? You're normally the one ranting, and for once, you actually struggled.
I took a back seat. I thought it's easy just to kind of sit back and listen, and to throw the odd bit in there, and then when I needed to make some comments. But it's I thought it was a good session still. So it's covered a lot of ground.
Well, the response has been very good so far. The response has been very good. So what did we talk about? I mean, we did a little bit about what's in the news, didn't we? Because as per usual, there's plenty happening in our fast-moving environment, particularly from a political standpoint, because we've had the, I've forgotten its name now, is it the Data Protection Information Bill? Is that what it's called? Bill, Dave, anyone? No.
I'm just looking. Data Protection Digital Information Bill.
That's the one. Just a snappy title, just for a change. So we spoke a little bit about that. We spoke a little bit about the ICO's conference, although we need some more input, I think, from others on that front. But mainly, the main reason you were with us today, Phil, was because we were talking all about audits, weren't we? That's the main reason you've come down as one of our main auditors here at DPP.
We were, yeah, and I was really quite interested to kind of pick this over again. I've been spending a lot of time the last few months out and about auditing. Now we can get on the site. It's just really, really nice to be, you know, getting in amongst people. Miles asked me to write a blog earlier in the week, so I wrote a blog about just really my thoughts on it. And what was interesting in the session, we were picking over some of the, you know, old stuff like the ICO's audit manual that they produced in 2001, which has still got some pretty relevant approaches. You know, it's still quite a relevant document to read despite being 21 years old and out of circulation. But it was really good, you know, get some good interaction with the participants. You know, what we were trying to do is kind of try and find, you know, good approaches, common ground. You know, we've got our approach, which is highly detailed, and you know, we approach it in a pretty structured way, looking at all 30 or so aspects of the GDPR and the PECA, and then, you know, in our report, you know, this is relevant and this is what we found, and therefore, you know, it's our opinion whether it's compliant or not. So we talked, you know, quite a lot of areas, and it was good to get input from other people about, you know, how difficult it is to assess compliance with things that are woolly like security, as compared to something that's prescriptive like the structure and content of ROPAs. And, you know, again, that was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that are interested in that framework that you mentioned, we're going to make that available in and around the blog that you originally wrote on the DPP website. So if anyone wants a copy of that, head to the website. You'll be able to get that there, as well as find all sorts of links to other bits and pieces we're doing, including the content calendar or the events that we've got coming up. One of the things that's worth pointing out is you'll hear us reference a number of things throughout this episode, but do not panic. We're back next week with another episode of GDPR Radio. If we don't cover it this week, we will pick it up next week. And one of the other things that we mentioned, Phil, was you're talking about the fact that you're retraining in terms of the PCI DSS, right? Because there's big changes to that.
Right.
And I believe that we have a bumper session for that, don't we?
We do. We've got a session planned. So I am retraining because there's a new version. So you have to retrain every year anyway, but we have to retrain on the new version now, version 4. And there's 58, I think it is, new requirements in the PCI DSS and lots of changes to the existing requirements, some quite big and some not so big. So I'm currently going through the official training for that. And what I try to pull out in this podcast was kind of PCI DSS is highly prescriptive. It tells you, you know, how to test procedures. When you're writing your report up, you've got to describe the testing procedures and the results. And I like to try and, you know, take that approach and apply it to GDPR auditing or PECA auditing, you know. So, you know, but the PCI is very prescriptive and the law isn't. So it's trying to find a happy medium, you know, where you're saying, well, you know, this is the requirement, you know, and this is what we found in terms of your ability to demonstrate meeting that requirement. And demonstrability is, again, that critical thing. I often go in and don't doubt that an organization, you know, is only processing personal data for, you know, legitimate, specific and explicit purposes. But how can they demonstrate that? Because the seventh data protection principle requires them to demonstrate it.
Yeah.
If you can't demonstrate it, you know, are you compliant or not? You know,
which was one of the key themes that we discussed. So I hope you're all looking forward to getting stuck into this. Dave, any thoughts on any of that before we get stuck in? We'll let the listeners listen to the main body of this episode.
Other than to say keep calm and carry on auditing, I think we're just jumping to the next session.
He had to get a pun in there somewhere. It's
fun, rubbish joke, more like.
Well, yeah, it's set producer Miles off, so yeah, we enjoy this. This is the thing, Phil, you've missed the past few weeks, but it's always like this with Dave. There's always some sort of bad joke or other type of pun involved, normally in the title of the session, but it was Miles's fault this week that we had quite such a cheesy name. Anyway, less said about that the better. Thanks both for your time. The listeners will be hearing plenty more from us in this episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, all about audits.
Have we got any items of news all there? I mean, I'm sorry to kind of dive in, but I mean, I'm really keen to know if anybody managed to get a ticket to the ICO conference, and if they did they boil to death whilst we're there? Obviously not to death, but did they boil themselves to a stew whilst we're there? And if it didn't go, then because I haven't actually seen anything relating to the conference at all. Have you, you know, anybody watched the sessions, or, you know, was it good? I don't know. So I'm interested to see if anybody went and what their thoughts are.
Well, you've done the segue for me, which is we'll talk a little bit about what's been in the news before we talk about auditing, but that's fine. Don't you worry. You're just excited, clearly, to get stuck into it. But no, obviously, I wasn't there at the conference. I don't think much to our shame, perhaps, and regret. I don't think anyone from DPP was in attendance.
Well,
we
applied for tickets, but you never get them. You know, I even applied as a DPO of one of the schools I work with, and I still didn't get a ticket. But you know, but you definitely don't get a ticket if you're in a private practitioner. We never get tickets for that. We only ever get tickets I've got tickets when we've been acting as a DPO. So I've been representing, you know, Everton Football Club before, and I think Rangers, and actually the school that I applied as the DPO this time, the Grammar School at Leeds, applied 2 or 3 years ago and I got a ticket, but this year I didn't. So it's hit and miss, really, isn't it?
Hit and miss. Well, Karen's saying that she usually gets a ticket, but nothing this year. So that would tend to track with what you're saying. Apparently it was all online and recorded, so we can go and consult that afterwards.
Yeah. It was, but I've not had a chance to go and have a look at it. We normally go and they normally have an exhibition as well, don't they? And we normally take an exhibition stand there. There's usually about, I don't know, 30 or so stands. You know, people like us, the ICO departments each have a stand. I mean, it's quite good when you actually go physically there. That's why I like going physically there. But like Michael Pennington, like Mike, I never managed to get let in either.
They never let our sort in, do they?
No, quite so.
So. If anyone's got any, no, go on.
Interesting. One of the things that did, because I did get the email from them saying, sorry, you didn't make it or whatever it says. But yeah, I was interested again that they've published all their DPO training materials. And if you haven't seen it, I'll put a link into the chat. Hopefully everyone has seen it. But I wondered if anybody's had a chance to look at them. I had a quick scan through the first one, What is Personal Data? And yeah, you know, yeah, what can I say? you know, some of it's quite good, you know, some of it I'm not sure about. But if you go here, all their training materials are available free of charge. So I've just put it in the chat.
Just on that with the training materials, that's part of the kind of the drive, isn't it, with the government and with the government reforms and on the data reforms and stuff for the ICO to push out more training materials. So it'd be certainly interesting to see what the standard, I've not looked at it, so I'd be interested to see from the link that you just put in the chat there, but I'd be certainly interested to see what the standard of the training that they're pushing out is in order to assess whether it's actually going to be something that you can rely on.
Well, I did have a quick scan through the, literally 2.39 minutes of the first session, data protection introduction. I was interested to see how they defined personal data. I thought, they're going to go into great lengths about, elaborating and helping us to understand this weird thing called, and they don't, they just literally read out what the definition is in the GDPR, any information related to an identified or identifiable living person, the data subject. And that's what the narrator says. Or then they say, and therefore my date of birth and my employee number are personal data relating to me. And then they move on. And I would have thought that they might have gone a little bit deeper. So, in our data protection in the workplace introductory training, we spend about 8 minutes trying to explore what personal data is, because it's a really obscure concept, movable concept as well. But ICO training just skips over it. Maybe there's other stuff that they issue as well. I don't know.
Well, just to echo what Dave was saying there, it is, as he said, reportedly part of the broader strategy around a lot of this. So that's interesting to see. And according to a couple people in the chat, it's what they use to train their own people internally. So possibly not a great boost to confidence in our regulatory environment. But
that's a terrible thing to say.
Particularly, it wasn't me. I'm just reading out the chat.
Okay.
Listen, do not put words in my mouth. What I was going to say is, it's interesting you mentioned there training about the concept of personal data, because just to segue slightly, and apologies if there's something more to be said on this, do come back to it. But obviously that definition perhaps might be changing slightly with the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, which has caused quite a stir this week. I'm sure you will all have seen this, even if you've not had the time like me to really sort of pore over the document. That's one of the things that is being tweaked from what I can tell. Any thoughts from either of you? I don't know. I assume neither of you have, like me, had time to really sort of dig into it properly. But just any thoughts at all on that at this stage? Anything that you've come across that you find? There we go. Phil's sharing it on screen for those of you who are with us live.
I'm just sharing bits of it. I mean, I have read through bits of it, and I'm going to write a blog about it next week. I don't know what anybody else thinks who may or may not have read it, but I wasn't expecting it to be structured like this. The UK GDPR is amended in accordance with subsections 2 and 3, section 2 and 3. Section Article 12A is now effectively inserted into the UK GDPR, or this is the proposal, isn't it, to allow us to have vexatious or excessive requests. So when you're reading this, you're jumping about between.
It's very difficult. It's worse than
just amends. It doesn't regurgitate everything. It just literally amends parts, doesn't it? So you're going to have several versions of it to actually understand what the heck it's saying.
Yeah. So manifestly unfounded being substituted for vexatious. And of course, you go into the DPA. Sorry, it's now referring back to the DPA, section 204A. And so reading it isn't easy, because you're jumping about between this, the UK GDPR, and the Data Protection Act. And I thought naively that this might be a rewrite combining the PECA, the GDPR, and the Data Protection Act, but it isn't, is it? It's just amending all three statutory instruments, which makes it hard. And there's some subtle changes that are just like something or nothing, what is the point in this, in a way? The applicable time period is defined as a month. Well, why are you changing it then?
Yeah, no, there is a lot of that, seemingly, a lot of rebranding, which is completely pointless. What I was just going to say is that arguably we could actually do with a keeling schedule here. Someone's put that in our session now, so sorry for stealing your point. But it was the first thing that came to me, particularly as you're saying there. It's very, very difficult to read. And arguably a sort of track changes keeling schedule would have been at least a little bit easier. But you're right, a lot of it's superficial, a lot of it's cosmetic. There are a couple of things that are interesting. One of the things that struck me is they're getting rid of or they intend to get rid of the requirement for European organizations to have a representative in the UK. That's going I know that's not necessarily the most glamorous one that people have picked out amongst all the proposed changes, but that sort of struck me.
There is a, just coming back to where we started with this, there is a proposed change to the definition of personal data within
Yes, I did see that.
So there's a bit of a change going on.
Yeah, again, all the, as far as I can see, all they're doing is taking out natural persons and putting in living individual, aren't they? It's not, that's the change, isn't it? So,
well, they're bringing in that the information is identifiable by the controller or the processor by reasonable means at the time of processing.
Well,
so it's, it extends it slightly. So it kind of, or it says that the controller or processor ought to know that the other person is likely will likely obtain the information as a result of the processing, and the individual will likely be identified by that person, blah, well, blah, 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 and all the rest of it.
That's great, because that's going to really clear everything up for us.
But it does come to the point, if you look at that in encryption, and if you're sending information abroad and stuff, it comes to a point that Ollie and I have often talked about, that if you pseudonymize things, is it identifiable by the organization that you're sending it to, if you're still holding the key and so on and so forth. And if it comes to this, is it reasonably identifiable at the time of processing, then potentially it isn't. But if the organization you're sending it to hasn't got the key to understand the pseudonymization in there.
But also worth bearing in mind that I think they're changing the concept of pseudonymization as well. I think I feel like I've seen that headline somewhere, that the definition of pseudonymization is changing as well. So it's going to be a lot for us to get to grips with, even if the changes are purely cosmetic and in terms of they're superficial. It's still, you know, the wording can be so important at times, and we all know that, particularly in an area of the law that has so much grey area to it, for it to be wholesale changes for no substantial or substantive reason is not helpful.
But I think some of them will be the devil in the detail once it's gone through the full legislative process and it's been decided. Because again, I've certainly read bits on this around the identifiability bit, where it states that the change in the definition of personal data will make it easier for businesses to achieve anonymization in the eyes of the law, because they would no longer need to concern themselves with the potential future identifiability, with the focus instead being on identifiability at the time of processing. So there's lots to discuss, lots to pull apart, lots to look at. And again, we have to wait and see what comes through once they've argued this between as it moves its way through the legislative process.
And one of the things which is worth pointing out, and I was going to make a point about this earlier, which is one thing that hasn't changed is the rhetoric around a lot of this, which is still get rid of EU this, and it's complicated, and we need to free ourselves and throw off the shackles.
These are the explanatory notes that come with the legislation. You know, and this point 12 here about it, you know, this approach, i.e. the European approach, in the government's view, can tend towards a box ticking exercise. And you know, one of the main reasons for changing it is because there is some uncertainty about the different lawful ground for which private companies can process personal data at the request of public bodies. What a load of old cobblers, in my opinion.
I share that opinion. I don't know if you read the contextual statement from the minister who presented it. That's available if you go and look for it. But basically, an introductory sort of speech to why they're putting this forward, and a lot of it is just nonsense. It's clearly been written by someone who's never actually picked up the law and tried to read
I think the point is it's the government's opinion, and the government's opinion has been so wrong on so many different grounds in so many different areas,
soapbox.
Well, it is. I mean, you don't have to go back so many years before the government thought that somewhere there was some weapons hidden in a sandpit, and it turns out that there wasn't. So we've got to be careful with government opinion. It really got to, we've got to go through the measures of bearing in mind that this is just their opinion, and they're entitled to have that, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And it would have been useful if they consulted with privacy practitioners and those who understood how it all kind of connects to better in places better, I would have said.
I agree with Ben on that point, that the GDPR is a doddle. It's easy to read, isn't it? It's well structured, it's well written. I think it is. It's easy to follow. And then you flick into the Data Protection Act and you're just diving about all over the place, aren't you?
I completely agree, but just to play devil's advocate, I suspect the reason they keep claiming that it's complicated is because it's not prescriptive. And I think they would prefer something which quite clearly says you have to do X, Y, or Z. People haven't got time to sit and think about what is an appropriate technical or organizational security measure. I suspect that's part of it. But I do think there's a point that's being made in the chat by a couple of people, but initially raised by Michael, which, nice to have you back with us, Michael, after a couple of weeks, all about the fact that one of the primary drivers behind all of this sort of in the same line as that rhetoric of free ourselves from Brussels, etc., is all to do with basically monetizing data, right? It's a lot of it's to do with scaling back. It's about liberalizing the use of data, right? Making it more accessible. There's a lot of it about, I can't remember the exact terminology they use, but maximizing the value of our data and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, we're going to save £1 billion a year from these reforms and all this sort of stuff. So
yeah, Joe's point about about changing the role, again, we talked about this, didn't we, the other morning, and we they're not really changing the, they're not taking away the role of DPO. What they seem to be saying is that you have to have senior, some person in senior management as being responsible. So you might have a DPO as well, but this is basically saying you can't really abdicate responsibility. You can't, you know, contract it out. Somebody in the organization, on the staff, has to be responsible. Now, whether that means then that people like us become non-exec directors just so we're on the senior management team and so on, so I don't know. But, you know, our reading isn't that you can't have an outsourced DPO. Our reading is you have to have somebody internal, but then you still might outsource to a DPO. But somebody internal has to be nominated as being the senior representative. We might be wrong, but that's how we read it anyway.
Well, yeah, and I've seen, interestingly, quite a lot of opposition to this, particularly within schools, apparently. I can't, you know, I'm not going to pass off that opinion as my own. I've just seen it from a couple of people that the education sector in particular are not particularly pleased about this, because they rely quite heavily on outsourced DPOs. And yeah, there's some interesting conversations happening here in that context. Steph saying that you need to keep up, Phil, because all this red tape is about getting rid of red tape.
Yes. Yes, I do need to keep it quite right.
Well put, and while I wholeheartedly agree with Victoria's point, I'm not going to read it out because otherwise I might get myself in trouble. Right, anything more to be said on this? Because we're about 20
minutes.
Plenty,
but we haven't got time really today.
Just very quickly
on it. I was reading something earlier that says the debt protection reforms are quite high, and the one of the first four things of Rishi Sunak, if Phil's local MP gets pushed to the top seat. And if that's the case, then the bill may start going through the process in September. I know we've often spoken on the webinars earlier and GDPR radio series earlier saying it might depend what happens at the top, who gets a seat, is it still going to be a priority and things. But I was reading somewhere saying that it is actually a priority of under Rishi Sunak to push. So that might put a different spin on things, on depending if he's successful or if he isn't for the top seat.
Mm.
Way to throw Phil under the bus there. That was...
I never said Phil voted for Rishi.
No, I'm not going to comment.
just felt a bit unnecessary.
He's frequently in and out of my village. Yes. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, moving swiftly on. Let's leave the news for now. But if there's anything that we've not mentioned, which obviously there's loads to be said on this. We're back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio, the open surgery, open forum type of session that we run every other week, and that will be an opportunity, if anyone's got any more questions or points they want to raise or anything that we've clearly glossed over, then do let us know and we'll pick it up next week. In the meantime, let's get on to the main subject for today's session. Now, the reason you're with us, Phil, for this one in particular is because you're effectively one of our designated and main auditors here at DPP, right? You run well, I think the overwhelming majority of them at this moment in time, don't you?
I have been doing, yes. And actually, it's been tremendous fun to get out in amongst people rather than having to do this remotely. So I've been all over the country doing a variety of audits in a variety of different organisations. And it's been really good fun, actually, getting back out and seeing what's going on and, you know, fine-tuning. You know, helping people to fine tune what's, you know, what their approach is. But I just thought it'd be useful because I wrote a blog earlier in the week for Miles about auditing, and because I had all this stuff rolling around my head and I had to just get some of it out on paper, and partly as a precursor for this. But I just thought it'd be worthwhile, again, finding out what other people thought and what other people were doing in terms of audits. So I don't know how you want to structure it all. I don't want to just ramble on about a load of old nonsense, but if you want to, you know, if you've got questions or some kind of discussion points. But I think I'll probably kick off by saying, I suppose, that as well as doing the GDPR auditing, the PECA auditing, I'm also going through the requalification for PCI DSS, retraining for the new version 4. So I know I say this quite a lot, so I'm always really interested to compare the approach that the PCI DSS requires against the, which is highly structured, highly prescriptive, against that which, you know, we do for audit. So we've tried to adopt a lot of those kind of structured processes in our GDPR audit methodology. But we've read audit reports from other people. When we pick up a new client, they say, we had an audit done, here's a report. And you think, God, blimey, you know, what have they done? You know, but maybe we're going overboard. So, for instance, when we're auditing, you know, retention, you know, what are we doing? And for me, I'm asking to go and have a look in systems and find the age of record. You know, well, that record, does it comply with the policy and the schedule? You know, but of course, all this takes a ton of time, doesn't it? If you've got 50 systems you've got to go and have a look at, well, there's a lot of time. Nobody's prepared to pay for that degree of, kind of granularity of approach. So, again, that's why I've got some, you know, so I've got my thoughts as a privacy practitioner. I'm sure everybody on here has got their own thoughts about how they do it or how they would expect it to be done in terms of an audit. So that's really why we wanted to have the session, wanted to just kick around auditing. Another thing, just stop me, Ollie, when you want, but
it's fine. You go on.
I thought, again, I don't know if people, but a lot of people on here have probably been around the block a lot of times and therefore have seen all these types of resources in the past. But if you haven't, then I'd be happy to kind of forward this on. It doesn't exist online anymore, but I have a copy in an archive and actually on a CD. But back in 2001, the ICA produced this audit manual of how to audit data protection, and it's absolutely brilliant. And a lot of it is still, you know, pretty relevant for today. So it goes through a lot of audit methodology, which is, again, useful. And eventually you end up with a load of compliance checklists. And I don't like audit checklists, you know, because I think they're too restrictive. But, you know, this type of thing is quite good to have a look at and think, actually, yeah, this, you know, this is how I'm just trying to scroll through it. Sorry to get to where I want to be.
I was just going to say people are very much asking for this to be shared. I think Miles, probably what we'll do is we'll put it out afterwards, either directly on the website or we'll send it around to people who are in attendance here with us. So if you're listening back to this, go head to the website. If not, if you're directly here live with us, then you'll be receiving a copy imminently.
I don't know how to send a copy imminently.
Oh, it's fine. Miles will facilitate. Yeah. Don't worry. Mark is asking you, though, what a CD is.
Well, in 2020, it's probably different from what it was in 2001 when I picked one up at the ICO conference, shall we say.
Shall we say. So, yeah, this framework, then, what were you scrolling for?
Well, this really, because it's going here, the adequacy checklist, you know, so it's saying, well, you know, when you're auditing the sixth data protection principle, for instance, you know, it's asking, you know, what document references and what comments you've got and what your result is in terms of your auditing of the fifth data protection principle or the fourth data protection principle. Or I mean, I was like the first data protection principle, particularly these days, because, again, Article 13 is quite prescriptive about what should be in privacy information, and that it's easy to test whether it's there or not. You know, then you got to decide whether it's accurate and comprehensive and well worded and all that type of stuff. But if there's no reference to retention, obviously it fails this test. Which kind of, I know I'm diving around a load of this, but it brings me to another point, which is when we're kind of reporting back. And I said in my blog that, you know, compliance is pretty Boolean. It's either you're compliant or you're not. You know, but if you took that approach with all the audits, no one would be able to demonstrate full compliance. So we've introduced kind of a partially compliant and largely compliant as two additional measures. And most of the time, you know, audits we're finding people are, you know, mostly compliant or partially compliant or not compliant. And in some areas, you know, they are compliant. If I try and find a example of our audit report template, so we're going through like 32 different measures, you know, like for instance, the requirement to register as a fee payer. So, you know, we, in our audit report, we're saying this is a requirement. What we found is, you know, you are registered and therefore you're compliant. But what I did an audit the other day, that there was three subsidiaries, you know, that were independent controllers that weren't registered. So theoretically, that's not compliant. But you know what we decided to do, or I decided to do as an auditor, say, well, yes, you're largely compliant, but you know, your corrective action is get these other ones registered, or it might be a recommendation. But we go through all these different points. This is what my approach. Again, I'm interested to test it amongst the community to see if everyone says you overkill, Phil, or you know, better way of doing it is X, Y, and Z. But again, we're testing ropers. You know, what are we looking for? You know, I'm looking for, is there a policy that determines how ropers are being maintained and who's responsible for them? And then I'm getting into the ropers and I'm saying, well, do they have all the different things that they should have that's specified in Article 31 or 32? And then getting into the ropers and saying, and are people making things up? You know, because a lot of people put their lawful grounds for processing in the ropers, which I think is an eminently sensible place to store them. But when you look at it and it says, you know, it's a system requirement, you say, well, that's not a lawful basis for processing. Just it's, you know, so then you kind of test, well, what have people put in there? And then I cross-reference the ropers to the privacy information. You know, are the same recipients listed or categories of recipients? Is the retention the same? Is the retention the same as in the retention schedule? Now, all this takes a load of time, particularly when you've amassed this evidence and you're back in your ivory tower, you know, looking at it all, thinking, can I get this to match across? And usually it doesn't. Mm. You know, again, so when you come into report back, you're saying, you know, are you compliant or not compliant or something in between? And I introduced this concept of assurance into my audit reports a few months ago because I went out to do an audit of a small business and we talked about subject tax requests and they scratched their heads and said, yeah, what are they? And I said, well, it's these rights people got, blah, 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 blah. Have you ever had any? No, we haven't. Right. So there's no evidence of non-compliance. Does that make you compliant? You know, so theoretically, you know, there's nothing to show they're not compliant, but they've got no framework or fabric to make sure they would be compliant if a SAR landed. So I was saying, well, you know, technically you're compliant because I can't find any evidence of non-compliance, but you've given me no assurance you'd ever get this right if one landed with you. So, you know, low level of assurance. And I'm rabbiting on, I'm going to stop now.
That's all right. Well, I was just going to come in because that specific example you mentioned there, I think is probably relevant because Victoria is sort of challenging you a little bit. Sorry, I don't want to make it sound adversarial, but on the idea that compliance is quite Boolean, which is not a term I'm familiar with, to be honest with you. I just said it's quite binary, but there you go. It's just semantics. But Victoria's saying that given their standards and what they consider to be compliant can legitimately differ. But I suppose this is kind of what you're getting at, which is that you can be quite binary about compliance. You're either compliant or you're not, but it's actually more interesting to look beyond that and more relevant and important even to look beyond that and say, well, technically you've not had any SARs, so you are compliant, but arguably from an assurance perspective, you can give me only very limited assurance because you don't know what they are, you don't have a process, you don't have the tools for it, you don't have a policy, no one's been trained on it, X, Y, Z. And I suppose that's, am I putting words in your mouth, or is that essentially what you're getting at? Which is the...
I think that some areas it's much clearer whether, you know, something is binary or Boolean, it is compliant or it isn't. You know, you get a subject tax request and you either deal with it within 30 days or, you know, additional 2 months, or you don't. And if you don't, well, you're not compliant, are you? If you have a privacy notice and it doesn't have the grant law for grounds processing, it isn't compliant. But other areas are much more difficult, and Victoria's absolutely right. You know, so when the most difficult area to audit compliance with, I think, is security. You know, what are we looking for there?
What is,
you know,
appropriate?
For me, I'm starting off thinking, well, we're meant to take a risk-based approach. So what evidence is there that this organization has taken a risk-based approach? Well, you know, hands up if you've got a risk methodology for documenting and assessing and reviewing data protection compliance risks. You know, maybe people have here, but most of the time they haven't. So you're already starting thinking, well, how have you determined which technical and organizational measures to implement against, you know, the risks if you haven't assessed the risks?
Well, surely part of assessing the risks is identifying the risks in the first place, wouldn't it?
Well, exactly, yeah. But again, this may happen in organizations, but when you're looking for evidence of it, in organizations, it's hard to find usually, in my experience anyway, you know.
At least possibly not in a properly structured format, right? You might have sort of, you know, bit part evidence over the all over the shop. You might have risks that come out of DPIAs. That's one of the number one things, is a risk comes out of a DPIA and then nothing happens with it, you know, whereas if you've actually got a proper risk management structure in place, you know, your evidence DPIAs all of a sudden is more accessible. Yeah.
And DPIs is another one of those areas where, you know, it's fairly, well, I start by thinking, right, have we got a policy and a procedure? Have we got a policy that we're going to do DPIs in certain circumstances, high-risk processing or anything on the ICO's list? Is there a procedure for doing it? You know, there might be some forms to fill in. There might be a screening questionnaire. And then, you know, on the ROPAs, are there things that leap out as saying high risk, like profiling or, you know, buying in data or something? And if there are, where's the DPIA on it? You know, because there should be one. And if there isn't one, then I would say, well, that you're not complying with your own policy, and you might not be complying with the GDPR. And if there is one, then I'm looking at thinking, is it any good? You know, what is it? You know, if it's a ticky box exercise, you know, for a complex profiling thing, then I'd say, well, that's probably, I'd argue, well, show me why it's adequate. You know, why aren't you explaining the algorithm? Why aren't you showing me the data flows in this DPA? And again, I'm finding a massive variation in the quality of DPA. So as an auditor, I'm on the side of, I got asked this a few months ago, you know, do you have to report your findings to the ICO? No, I'm on your side. You know, I'm there to try and pick over things from a different perspective with a very kind of professional and experienced lens to try and help identify areas of non-compliance and areas for improvement. And, you know, with that comes, you know, I've seen this working really well down the road, you know, so you should have a think about whether that would be a better way of doing it.
Yeah, which, you know, you're arguably acting as the critical friend there. I think the next thing I wanted to look at, I mean, Dave, I don't know if you've got anything.
Steph's right. Steph is right that, you know, the question really, I think, Steph, is the auditor there to try and gloss over things to make sure they get the gig next year? I don't. there could be a tendency for doing that.
Well, beyond that, arguably there's perhaps a risk of that if you are working within certain other frameworks. So there's been mentions in the chat of ISO 27001, 7701, etc. Is there a risk that if you are working towards that, or if you already have it in place, that you become over reliant on your compliance with that standard to the detriment of, you know, your wider compliance program or your wider, you know, risk management program from a GDPR perspective?
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on the quality of the program, really. I was surprised a few months ago. I was doing an audit down in Fareham, and, you know, have you got a suite of policies? Yes. Are they reviewed annually or periodically? Yes. Look, they're reviewed annually. But, well, why has it been reviewed twice? And it's got the old 8 principles in it. Who the heck has reviewed it? You know, what? It like beggars belief to me as a, you know, as a, and it hopefully does to everybody here, you know, privacy practitioner. And I agree with the last comment, you know, it is good practice to change your audit firm and your auditor, you know, every few years just to test the prior work.
Yeah. No,
I think one thing that I know we've spoken about it previously, Phil, when we're looking at audits, is trying to understand from the starting point what we're actually trying to achieve. Which is why we've got that assurance bit, and why I like the assurance bit within our audit plan. Because if you're looking for assurance from an audit, well, what do you actually check, and how much do you have to check in order to get that assurance? And is the volume of what you're checking statistically valid, and all that kind of stuff to go look? Let's say you pulled apart the ROPA, let's say the ROPA has got 300 entries on it or something like that. You then taking a statistically valid sample in order to test and make sure that it's fully there, in order to give some kind of compliance that your ROPA is actually fit for purpose, it is being maintained, deep assurance in that sense. Or are you literally, from a compliance point, going, have we got a ROPA? Is it being maintained? Does it roughly reflect what we do? Is roughly what's in there within our privacy policy? And is that the level that we're aiming at?
Well, that was one of the questions I was going to pose, because, you know, one thing that really came out when Phil was talking just a minute ago was, you know, really your value to a certain extent is going to be in granularity and how granular you're going, how closely you're inspecting some of these elements. But then my question was going to be, you know, how do you actually define that scope? What is it that determines how granular you're going to be in certain areas and not others? Do you base it on existing audit results? Do you base it on, you know, broader strategic targets you have? Do you base it on, I don't know, what's, is there an answer, Phil, or what's your experience been like in terms of determining a proper scope for this type of thing?
My experience is that many of the people we work with struggle to define the scope, and they rely on us to try and define the scope, and maybe, you know, we're going too broad. You know, so we're looking, we're trying in a typical assessment to assess all processing, you know, across a whole organization. That's generally where we start from, and therefore, you know, it is big, and there's never enough time allowed, and you know, to actually get out there and interview people and obtain evidence, and you know, then you got to go back and review it all and cross tabulate it and correlate it, and then you got to write up a report, which took me 2 days last week to write up a report. Because you're having to cross reference it all and give evidence. Well, I like to give evidence in the report. Another thing I've started to do is, again, because the trouble is the reports get quite long, is to try and show this might not work. People might start howling at me now saying this is just nonsense. But, you know, we've got different categories. So we've got a spreadsheet of different categories, all the governance stuff like ICO registration, representatives, ROPAs, accountability, DPO. And then we allocate a notional score. If it's non-compliant, they get a 0. If it's fully compliant, they get a 3. And that way we can have a look at, again, we've only been doing this for 6 months or so, so we haven't really got loads of data to say this is a really good approach or it's a pile of rubbish. But it's just a way of trying to see, you know, are you strong in application of the principles? In security, we're measuring, you know, these are the things GDPR asks for, isn't it? Risk-based approach, protecting data, confidentiality, integrity, availability, resilience, restorability, and monitoring and testing controls. So that's what we're trying to measure against. And we're looking for evidence that these areas are under control. And then it is very subjective. You know, at the end of the day, it is subjective. But the objective is to try and help someone to determine the degree of compliance. So that's what we're trying to do. And if we think that they're weak in a particular area, then, you know, we need to be helping to identify that area and how to remediate that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the whole objective thing is interesting, because just to come back to something that Dave was saying a second ago, because Steph agrees with me in the chat, saying, you know, do you want insurance or reassurance out of the exercise? Insurance is, you know, the risk and choose what to do about it. Reassurance is, it'll be okay. And I would probably echo that, because I've seen instances where working with organizations, you know, the audit's been done, but it might have been done a while ago, and now the entirety of compliance efforts are focused on remediations from that audit. Now, don't get me wrong, that is going to improve things for you, but if you are solely focused on the outcome of an audit that was maybe done 3 years ago and remediating that, there's a good chance you might be missing things that are going on around you at the same time. So it's probably important to really define from the outset what it is you want out of your audit, I'd have thought, as part of defining your scope. But I might be wrong on that. Victoria makes a good point, which is that things like breaches and complaints could be significant in determining your scope in that respect. Dave, you've been awfully quiet throughout all of this.
I think he's fallen asleep.
I don't know if you had anything to add on that, or if there's anything else that you wanted to look at, because I think we've sort of given the whistle-stop tour there of some of the main bits. We've spoken about scope, we've spoken a little bit about your methodology, Phil, although I'd like to come back onto that maybe in just a minute. You know, ideas of compliance versus assurance. Dave, is there anything that you wanted to pick out specifically in all of this?
Yeah, well, I'd like to pick out one thing I particularly like is the framework for 27001 for their audits. You're expected to do so many audits across the framework in a year. So therefore, you get this kind of continuous impression that at a point in a month, something is being looked at to check that it is still in place. And then towards the end of the year, you might get your recertification audit or a surveillance audit or whatever the terms that they use. But you've got this continuous activity going on. And when I've ever been involved in audits, it's usually where we've not had one for a few years. We'd best have something. But then there's nothing in the intervening period. There's nothing kind of showing, well, have you done something internally? Have you got your internal audit program where you might spot check something? You're not doing everything as an overview, but have you spot checked something? Have you kind of just done a bit of an audit on your ROPAs? Have you looked at your DPIAs? Have you made sure your breach logs completed properly in the assessments of whether you're notifying the ICO has been determined correctly and that kind of stuff? But you don't, I've not seen that outside of trying to in essence put kind of the framework of 27001 and the essence of what that achieves through regular monitoring into a wider kind of general audit framework. So you should be doing bits every month in order to say that you've covered it over the course of the year and looking for opportunities for improvement and things. And I like that approach. And I was just wondering whether anybody takes that approach with their own audits or whether it is just a case of we haven't had one for a bit, let's have an audit.
Well, it's a very good point because I was going to bring it back and you kind of touched on it there. I was going to bring it round and ask for your opinion, the two of you, on everything surrounding the DPO's monitoring, because I know, Phil, you and I spoke about this just the other day. You know, how do you actually demonstrate that as the DPO you are monitoring the activities of the organization, monitoring compliance? How do you record that? And I suppose because there's going to be a lot of crossover there in theory with your auditing schedule, with your auditing regime, because if you're doing, you'd have thought if you're doing your job properly as the DPO, you could almost run an audit and say, well, let's just have a look, make sure the DPO is checking everything correctly, right? Because there's going to be a lot of crossover. Or am I simplifying that possibly?
It's probably like you've read my mind, Ollie, as if I just kind of set you up for that question. Because if the DPO is appropriately resourced, then they should be undertaking monitoring activities and they should be themselves looking into similar areas as to potentially what you'd cover in an audit. The difference for me, very bluntly, would be an audit is kind of done over a prescribed period of time. Let's say 5 days, that kind of thing. Whereas the DPO is taking it over the cross, a small bit of that, but doing everything over the course of 12 months, for example. And I know that our DPOs, and when we set our framework up for monitoring, it is looking at, well, what do you do about breaches? What do you do about DPIAs? What are you doing about previously by design and so on and so forth through the DPO's monitoring activities. So it's just trying to give a little touch to the DPOs. They should be doing it, but obviously some DPOs are have resourcing issues because of the pressures internally. So she's kind of nodding to that bit slightly.
And you might find also that it's from a politics perspective, you're going to find it easier to get the resource for getting an external auditor in, you know, someone a bit flash to come in and look at everything for you than necessarily giving that time and resource and support to the DPO to do it internally. Because to my mind...
There's two things. The DPO should be doing it on a regular basis, because part of the DPO's role is to monitor. So what are you doing to monitor? Can you demonstrate your monitoring bits over the course of 12 months? That doesn't necessarily negate an annual audit, an external annual audit, in order to, not say we're doubting the DPO, but coming back to the very similar kind of argument, as it were, where you change your auditor or your audit company every 2 or 3 years just to make sure that the previous one's picking up on everything, whereas it's trying to, the DPO is independent, but they're doing the internal audit regularly, or small bits of that regularly over a course of a year, but doesn't necessarily negate the large external audit or periodic large external audit just for that further assurance.
Well, one of the things that you know, again, I would look for when I'm looking at is the compliance management approach audited. As I'm looking for those as an auditor, I'm looking for those internal mechanisms. You know, I'm looking at, you know, what is the DPO doing in terms of spot checks? You know, what is the internal audit process if there is any? You know, where's the evidence of this? Because accountability, you need evidence, don't you? So, you know, ideally, the external audit is auditing the internal audit processes, but in the main, there isn't really an internal audit function in most organizations that we work with, you know, that is looking at this kind of stuff. I mean, back in the day when I was years ago in the hotel trade, you know, we had ISO 9001. We had an internal audit team. And then the external auditors would come in and audit the internal audit processes. And that would be it. That's all they're interested in. If they found fault with the internal audit processes, they'd go dig a bit deeper. But they were just looking at, you know, have you got this under control? And if you have, then that's fine.
I've worked previously in an internal audit team that worked that way. You did all the internal audits and then the external team just audited yourself in that sense across the benchmark, across the framework to make sure that your findings were appropriate, et cetera, et cetera. They may do a bit of spot checking, but I've worked in internal audits, in teams of internal audits that's worked that very way.
Yeah. I mean, James's point is spot on, isn't it? An audit is a snapshot. Again, we say that in our report. It's a snapshot in time. We can only look at, you know, what we are exposed to. If you bury a load of... I mean, I went to a private healthcare provider probably 3 years ago now, and they told me that everything was all in the cloud. So when I opened the cupboard and found it full of servers, I nearly fell over. What's this? Oh, this is just a backup, all the production environments in a nice secure server, but that's your vulnerability, this cupboard with all these servers in. That was unbelievable. But if I hadn't opened the door, you know, I would have gone on and written an audit report saying security is all dealt with by a third party professional data center. Far from the truth.
Yeah, I know you've got a couple of stories like that, which actually with about 10 minutes to go, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, Phil, but if you give us, because that's a good example. I know about your, I mean, admittedly, the story about the servers above the kebab shop are in the context of a processor audit, but it probably still scans. Have you got any more horror stories like that you want to share with us? Any particularly good ones? I mean, I know Dave's got a couple as well, and Dave, feel free to share. Unfortunately, I mean, in the time that I've been with us, I've not done too many audits. This is where I've signed myself up for the next batch, but
I haven't got that one in particular was a horror story, because, you know, one of the things that this private healthcare provider had to do was fill in the toolkit, the NHS toolkit, the DSP for various providers. And they, you know, I looked at some of their returns and it was absolutely made up. It was complete lies. Anyway, they'd send people, I also looked at some complaints they had, they'd send people the wrong operation on the wrong eye, you know, things like that, because they were so disorganized. They were managing appointments for 13,000 people a month in Outlook, you know, moving stuff around in these multiple diaries. It was an absolute disaster zone. And I went in the MD's office to work, and there was piles of hard disks, and it was just an unbelievable mess. And that was one of the worst. It kind of debriefed me, and they said, "Well, how?" I said, "You are one of the worst places I've ever been in."
So you sugarcoated it then?
It was horrendous, horrendous. Yeah. I mean, all the letters to go out were piled on top of a confidential waste bin, and they were falling out of the printer over the back. It was just disaster. Everywhere you looked, it was a disaster.
Michael's taken upon himself in the chat to sort of highlight that everyone fibs on the DSP too. It's more of a wish list than anything else, right. Which I couldn't possibly comment. Dave, any horror stories you want to tell us about? I remember one you told me a while back where they were big on their physical security and they locked doors and everything, but then would just pop the key above the door frame. That's one that sticks with me.
Yes, yeah, it's thanks for reminding me of that. I've just got past the memories, but yes, there were. Leaving keys to the offices in the recessed door frame, and when I asked them why the key was there, it's the answer was the cleaners know how to get in, that kind of thing. And you're kind of going, well, it's not just cleaners, it's everybody else walking around the office around the block. You do appreciate that kind of thing, but it's just the complete lack of awareness. This place, I won't go into it too much because we shouldn't, because it's a client.
Just don't.
Yeah, but it's the perimeter security, shall we say, if we word it in that sense, was probably about okay. But it's once you you got inside the buildings, it's like security stopped at the perimeter. And once you got inside the buildings, like I said, there was keys above door frames. Once you got into the office, drawers weren't locked. There were highly personal sensitive information in drawers that weren't locked. So once you got into the office, you could have identified quite a lot of bits and pieces in there. I was asking questions about the destruction of hard documents, and they convinced me that they only use the shredded bins or something similar, where you stick it in the bins and it gets collected, that kind of thing. But then on a security walk around, we just happened to find, if you could believe it, three shredders. When I asked them what the shredders were there for, they weren't even aware they had shredders in the building. And it was a building that if you were going to shred something, it had to be a particular grade of shredding because of the sensitivity and the nature of the client in that sense. And it was just scary. Like I say, it's perimeter and that's it. It's a free-for-all once you get in.
I love
things like passwords as well. Passwords written down on whiteboards, all that kind of.
All that sort of stuff.
Really?
I was just going to say, I love Lucinda's story in the chat saying that she was once undertaken an internal audit and found an unsecured drawer full of special category data with a GDPR e-learning completion certification on the very top of the pile, which is absolutely fantastic. Okay, well, we've got about sort of 5 minutes left to run on this. I'm just conscious of time. So what I really want to sort of drive home before we do sort of start to wind down is, because we've spoken a lot about some of the theory around this, we've spoken a lot about, you know, some of the implications of all this, but I wanted to really get into, you know, what do people need to do, what are some of the top tips, what are some of the key takeaways that people can really sort of take home with them. I mean, one of the things that's come out of this already is people saying that they want to implement more formal auditing schedules as part of their DPO monitoring, so that's a good thing and one which I think we'd all support here. But is there anything else that really you would want people to take away from this session in terms of how they structure things, how they look at things, maybe how they report them, how they define their scope? We've spoken a lot about that, bits and pieces around that really you'd like to drive home. Phil, I guess I'll come to you first because you're in the midst of it. But
well, I haven't got I don't think I'm in a position to give anybody top tips or advice. I primarily wanted to kind of kick around approaches and methods and, you know, see what other people are doing. And I'll tell you what is my overriding thought about this is that we should have a standard to audit against. Yeah. So the ICO's audit handbook, whatever it's called, that they used to have was quite good. Yeah, we're quite doing that. But one of the why don't we write a certification scheme for auditing is what I'm thinking, so that everybody's doing it the same way if they're wanting to, you know, audit to a certified standard. So GDPR provides the framework or the ability to have certified things, doesn't it? So I'm very tempted to start writing an audit certification and putting it to the ICO to see if they'll approve it, but I can't do it on my own. You'd need to do it as a community. But it would be good if we knew that there was a standard, that covered all the things we've talked about, you know, scoping of audits, sample sizes of audits, audit methodology, how to apply a certain rating, you know, to compliance, and how to report back, you know, how to group things together, how to measure stuff that's tricky like security. It would be useful, wouldn't it? Well, that's what I think.
No, I'd agree.
I think it would be very useful. I would support that, yeah. Sorry, Ollie.
No, I was just gonna come to you before pointing out there's a couple of questions in the chat. Yeah. I'll put to you both in a second, but do go on.
Yeah, no, for me, from my time when I was working in internal audits, and this is many, many moons ago now, I guess the principle still stays the same: is just challenge absolutely everything, even if you think the evidence looks good, just challenge it. In that sense, you hear nonsense terms like, oh, this is good. And it's like, well, if it's good, demonstrate it's good. Show me that it's good. And the reason why I say that is because, like I say, an example sticks with me. Years and years and years ago, I had to check an official register that somebody, a director, somebody quite helping the organization was periodically signing. And when you looked at the register, periodically the director had signed where he's due to sign. And I was thinking, well, on the face of it, from an evidence point, you could say, well, I've randomly checked several days, and there's a relevant signature next to it. That should be okay from an audit point. But I challenged that. I went to find out when the director's was in, and got his schedule to find out the several of his dates that he signed the book on the day, and it's a legal document that he was signing, that kind of stuff. Several of the days he was actually on holiday in Tenerife. So it's like, just check and challenge everything. Don't just take words and that kind of stuff. Really, yeah. Challenge the evidence. Well,
when I did my 9001 audit training years ago, the tutor, and remember this, he says, auditing is as simple. It's as simple as ABC. I accept nothing, believe no one, and challenge everything. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that's the right approach, but certainly keep that in the back of your mind. You know, you're getting told something, fine, great, show me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The challenge doesn't have to be adversarial, but you don't have to just accept first terms of what people come out with.
But I was going to Steph saying how much should you know is a reasonable budget for an audit, and that depends on the scope, and I know I keep rabbing on about this. I'm going to come back to the PCI DSS, right? So when we're doing a PCI audit, it's completely prescriptive. It tells you what you got to do, how you've got to do it, you know, what the testing procedure is. This is, I'm going to put up on the screen here, you know, this is just one example. So there's a requirement to synchronize time across the network, yeah, all the servers and everything, all the switches, everything, and it tells us what we've got to do, you know, how we've got to go, you know, we've got to go and examine the system configuration, we've got to get onto the systems and actually have a look at how time is being maintained and check that about against the policy. So, you know, we're doing a PCI DSS assessment. It's 10 days on site often, you know, and quite a lot of days writing up, but then it is so prescriptive, and of course 10 days on site costs thousands of pounds for the customers, but you know, if you're a level one merchant or service provider, then it's one of those things you build in. Nobody's really used to paying, you know, for a data protection audit. We normally take half a day, you know, reading documentation in advance and preparing, a couple of days if we get that on site, and then a day or two of or day reviewing evidence and writing up, maybe that takes 2 days. So it's usually a week's work, you know, a couple of days on the site, and then, you know, a day off site following up and looking at evidence. But I'm going to ask this question. You know, we often get asked to do a gap analysis, and, you know, what's a gap analysis? Why is that not an audit? You know, what is an audit? What's a review? What's a gap analysis? What's a detailed assessment? You know, are we using the same language when we're talking about this type of stuff?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
For me, and I think the cost also comes down to what's the actual scope and what you're trying to achieve. If you're looking for deep assurance, then obviously it's going to take a lot more work. If you're looking for, well, is the framework in place? Does it all look about right? Have we got some applicable measures in place? Well, that's a lot less, because you're not going for the assurance. You're just going a check of the framework. So to me, it comes down to the scope of the audit or compliance check, whatever you want to call it, and the level of detail that's to be achieved.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I don't have anything to add to that from either of you. I mean, one of the things that we've not really touched on, we've mentioned it, but there is a clear parallel to be drawn in terms of what we're looking at here. And as Michael points out in the chat, third-party vendor audits, and where you can sort of, you know, learn, you know, gather learning and experience from one or the other, because we all know that's a very different kettle of fish. But you know, it might be interesting to look at that at a future date. I think that's probably going to be it for us on this one. I don't, as I say, have anything really to add to what you both have kicked around there. Before we wrap up, any sort of more closing thoughts from either of you? I know you've sort of given us your primary takeaways from this, but is there anything else that you want to cover, or conversely, anything which maybe if we look to do another session on this topic, which you might like to look into in greater detail? I know, Phil, you're looking for really sort of, I suppose, feedback, a collaborative approach to this, you know, to sort of get other people's takes on things. So whether we sort of do a slightly more workshop style event in future, but anything from either of you before we wrap up?
I'll let you go first, Phil.
Well, I was just going to say, I apologise if I've rabbited on too much and monopolised and gone down rabbit holes, but you know how I am.
No, that's why we bring you along. It's
wheeling me out.
It's Dave or I will be ranting if you're not, so don't you worry. But no, thanks for that, Dave. Anything from you?
Yeah, the only final thing for me is if you're not doing audits and compliance checks, you need to start thinking about them as a way to evidentially demonstrate that you've understood the law and you've got reasonable measures in place to demonstrate how you do that. So if you're not doing them, you need to do them. And if you're not doing them frequently enough, you maybe need to start thinking about the frequency cycle. But that's an internal decision. Happy to discuss it with you, but that's an internal decision that you need to look at if you're not doing them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And if anything here has got you worried, then you know, there's probably no need to panic. But if you do need any help with that, it'd be remiss of me not to plug DPP as an option for you to consider going forwards. On that note, we will go and record the intro to this for our podcast listeners, but thank you all very much for your time this afternoon. Thanks for coming and joining us on this. We very much enjoy having you with us. It's what makes it so fun. Phil, Dave, good to have you with us this afternoon. Thank you both very much for your time and insights. I very much enjoyed that. It's always nice to be able to take a bit more of a back seat on these. And Phil, you certainly deliver on that front. But it's been great to have you back with us. I think everyone has very much enjoyed that. To all those in attendance, as I say, thank you all very much for your time. We're back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio. So as I say, anything that we've not mentioned here you want to bring up, do let us know. And as you'll all be aware, there's a jam-packed calendar of events available on the DPP website to find out everything about what's coming up in future. We may do another one on audits. What do we think, chaps? Maybe at some point in future?
And if people want us to.
I guess the question then, Ollie, is audit or not to audit? That is the question.
Audit or not to audit? That is the question. I believe producer Miles maybe wants to come in on this topic. He's just darting out of the room. 16th of September, we're doing audits again. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's free.
It's free. So if anyone's interested, we can do more on audits. I'm going to ignore Dave's pun. He normally gets them in the intro, which we're about to go and record. So that could be insufferable. Anyway, that's enough from us. Thanks all for your time. We'll catch
up with
you
all
very soon. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Dave. Catch you
later. Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Cheers.